Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of our podcast about Australian speculative fiction. Now, again, I'm joined by David and Lucas.
Hello.
Hello. And for this section, David and Lucas were in a little bit of a discussion about who should be hosting it. As you can see, that's why it ended up being me. But the issue is, we are discussing Ellen van Nerven's short story Water, and Lucas and David found that it fit both of their genres in a way. So we have David with magical realism and Lucas with science fiction. So why don't you guys start and explain how and why Water belongs to a variety of genres, maybe?
Well, David, you may go first.
I'm being rude and just claiming the right to speak first. Sorry, I should give it back and you the go. Sorry.
All right, fine. Now I know that David is not actually the strongest supporter of his own argument on this one. So I'm gonna come in barreling on this, but I know that David also is a little bit unsure about whether it's sci-fi to some extent. Mm. But let's think about what we have in this story. We have aliens. Sure, they're not extraterrestrial, they're terrestrial, but they're aliens as far as we would determine them. A life form that is a non-human agent with foreign or alien characterizations. Of course, this is definitely just kind of a veil of othering. Check out the Othering Buzz video. But that is a very staple sci-fi kind of thing. We also have a very scientific approach to this whole situation. We have ecological concerns that are being brought up. We're talking about chemicals, pouring them onto things. This is very scientific in the sense that we are actually approaching and enacting a kind of science in the story. Lastly, I would say that because this is about post-humanity, actually, as we come to find out, this kind of overall concern is very politically engaged, very philosophically engaged with kind of the core of science fiction. A lot of sci-fi is about this. Go back to Frankenstein. What is it about? It's about non-human agents. It's about seeing what happens next.
Yeah, thank you, Lucas. Mm. So, David.
Yeah, let's see how I can respond to that. Because the thing is, I was going to use Water to talk about magic realism, not because I want to push it into the magic realism box. Rather, I was going to use it to make a point about why I personally think that magic realism sometimes is a pretty inapt or not so useful category, or at least an unfortunate label, I personally think, when it comes to looking at indigenous writing, when it comes to applying it to indigenous writing, because I think we discussed this elsewhere earlier, magic realism is always a kind of a marketing strategy. You know, it's a sales thing. Not only is it an analytical tool or category, but more often than not, it's a sales thing. It works to sell a text. And Lucas just made a wonderful point, I think, about how Water fits into so many different categories, and which makes it an all the more interesting text. I just wanted to raise the concern that with Water, of course, we are talking about, in my view and in my reading, a highly political text because it talks about indigenous sovereignty. It talks about matters of indigenous self-representation and self-government, issues that are highly current and highly they're hot in Australia at the moment, always have been. So what happens then if we apply a label, and again, I'm not trying to contradict anything that Lucas just said, this is just my angle. What happens to such a text and to such a literary product or project or agenda if we call this a piece of magic realism? Doesn't it profoundly water down political argument that is inherent in that literary text? And I just can't help thinking, Lucas, you made a very good point saying that the plant people are aliens of sorts. They are not extraterrestrials, but they are aliens. That is, they are being constructed as aliens on the level of the plot, and readers might think of them as aliens, and I'm pretty sure this is a deliberate move when it comes to narrative choices and all that. Mm-hmm. But isn't that exactly the point? And isn't that so interesting? Because it turns out those are ancestral beings. They are ancestral spirit beings. That is, they are as indigenous as it gets to that place. They are being constructed as aliens. And doesn't that harken back to very racist history of politics in Australia where Indigenous people have continuously and still are being viewed as aliens to that continent, right?
Yeah.
And that nation, for that matter. So.
Absolutely. I believe that this point, this similarity is actually addressed in the text itself, isn't it? Trying to find the page. Mm-hmm. Are there any reasons why you think other people might construct it as magic realism? I mean, you chose it for your section on magic realism for a reason, right?
Yeah, as I said, because I wanted to talk about, and we are talking about that, why magic realism can be an unfortunate label and a misleading label, because I wanted to drive home how there is something going on in the text, the plot and its message, if we assume for a moment that the author is alive and not dead, that magic realism can gloss over and pretty much erase from that consideration. Because magic realism, of course, when we talk about it from a structural point of view, where something that is real becomes hijacked or inhabited by something that is not real, and where something new emerges out of that confluence. But still there is that notion of the marvelous, the fantastic, the awe-inspiring sort of fantastic thing that, you know, I feel, and this is something I keep thinking about a lot, and I'm not assuming or laying any claim whatsoever to the arguability of that position, it's just my thinking. This very thing that is happening cognitively, right, when thinking about magic realism, might allow a reader to approach the text differently, is to not take it seriously as a piece of literary politics because, this is magic realism, right? Or this is marvelous realism. There's something fantastic happening. I don't have to take it seriously. I can step back from the stuff that is being talked about. On the other hand, however, I am perfectly ready to accept that you could come at it from the opposite direction and say, no, magic realism actually enables that very, that very politics, but it still have to be convinced.
I think, Lucas, I'm going to give the word over to you in a moment. I just wanted to say, I think your argument, David, really depends on the reader as well, doesn't it?
It does. It's
there are readers like us, we read speculative fiction anyway, and we wouldn't take a message less seriously because of a label that might be magic realism. It might also be fantasy, because with the fantasy label as well, there are people who say, it's just fantasy, it's make-believe. Mm. And yet fantasy is often used to criticize social phenomena, to criticize a certain kind of politics. Mm-hmm. So I think it really depends on who's reading a text.
Absolutely. And to stress that this is just me thinking, and just me speaking here, and this is my own kind of idiosyncrasy going on. And I'm, as I said, I'm not claiming that anybody should subscribe to that that approach. I am just worried about the label, and I'm generally uncomfortable with labels. Thought that water would be a good way to maybe unpack how labels can be misleading and how labels can maybe distract stuff, but none of that is authoritative.
I guess, it's certainly interesting. I do see your point, absolutely. Lucas, you were going to say something.
I was. I guess the final word on genre might be kind of hearkening back to a rough draft of this very, very podcast when we filmed not on Zoom, but over audio call, which was not ideal. At that time, David said, but it doesn't really feel like sci-fi. And I think he's right. I tried to lay down kind of a simple argument of like, look at these sci-fi things, it's gotta be sci-fi, but really it doesn't work that way. That's one of the reasons why, as a joke, I basically call all of these texts gothic as much as I can, because I feel like you can argue that they are. And the instability of the genre, I think, is what's really, really important here. And we can definitely glean something from how there are not sci-fi novels very much that are considered sci-fi when they are in an Aboriginal context. Terra Nullius maybe is one of the exceptions here. Maybe not. but it's something worth talking about because there is kind of this idea of like a marketability factor. Like maybe you can't critique it quite as effectively if you're in the sci-fi category. Maybe you can't if you're in the magical realism category.
Mm-hmm. Right. There's fantasy authors of color who I think I mentioned that in another podcast as well, who complain about being classed as classic as magic realism because they're only being put there because it's more marketable, but it's not how they see themselves.
Mm-hmm. That's it. That's my point. Thank you very much, Tina. You made it much more concise. That is, in a nutshell, what I meant to say. Thank you.
Well, I'm glad I managed that quite by accident. Lucas, actually, I remember when we were first talking about our reading selections for this course, yep. We talked about water, and we talked about whether it's science fiction, because I had read some secondary literature that says it is science fiction. And you already argued that it didn't feel like science fiction. You said, oh, it could be fantasy. And then I said, but it doesn't feel like fantasy. So really it does show the fluidity of this text that we're talking about. Right. I did find the quotes that I was looking for, and I think awesome. That'll lead us nicely onto another topic. If you have the short story in front of you, it's on page 94, mm-hmm. where the main character is talking to this person working in the science center. It starts with, I feel it's part of my job, it's ethical. And the other person says, oh, we're talking about plants here. Mm-hmm. And then there's this entire argument about they're not just plants, you must know that. They're not entirely human though, are they? And this employee at the science center says, we've been having these debates for years about scientific testing on animals for medical research. At the end of the day, we have to put humans first. Mm. And our protagonist counters that with, so that's science. Science is biased to the human race. Mm. This is sounding like social Darwinism, like the twisted justification of treating black people worse because of their race and skin color. So we have here the parallel pretty much stated outright in the story. Yeah. Yes, David.
And just relating to that, I just want to stress for everybody who's watching this, this was actually a debate in Australia because up until the 1967 referendum, Aboriginal people in Australia were not classed as citizens, but were categorized under flora and fauna. I just want to stress that. So weren't citizens, not classed as human beings, but were under flora and fauna in the Australian legislation until that very date. And of course, this goes back to a long history of Western scientists debating whether or not people of color are actually humans, or not rather animals, advanced animals, you know, or part of the flora for that matter. Mm. So it's all right here on the page.
Absolutely. And of course, that thought of dehumanizing an entire group of people is horrifying. And here we have this entire debate sort of moved to this category of the plant people. And it's addressing all kinds of issues about non-humans, non-human agency. It is addressing this historical issue that you have addressed, that Aboriginal people were classed as flora and fauna. But in contemporary times, we could also see it from another angle, in that the binaries between the human and the non-human are also being questioned these days. So do you have any thoughts on that?
Lucas, you want to go first?
Yeah, sure. When it comes to the situation that's laid out here, I think we're kind of trapped in a little bit of a paradox. We kind of get tricked into believing, I think, that this is an alien type of being by means of the strategy of the writing. And I think that's effective. Part of that is because of this language we're couched in the beginning. By referring to social Darwinism, we are referring to, you know, the beginning of War of the Worlds. We're referring to the same kind of discussion about Darwinism and evolution being connected to two species coming into contact with each other. And because of that, we kind of come up with this association. We also have like this idea of relationship between the non-human other and the human other happening right at the same time. Mm-hmm. In this story, that's very important, the intimacy of this relationship, although I don't know if we'll have time to get into that. But what I find as being the most kind of pivotal point or something like that is reading is used as like a vessel for a construction of agency or subjectivity.
Mm-hmm.
But as I think I maybe argued once before in my life, that seems like a very human idea, that reading is connected to subjectivity, or that notions of a different and other needs to rely on an epistemic system that we use to build our civilization, as if that is a stepping stone for some kind of communication that we could have. We have no idea if that's the case. And certainly by using this, I think it almost foreshadows the inevitable outcome, which is that our non-human other is just us, but it was us before. It was our past.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a good point. You talked about the strategy of how these non-human others are being introduced in the story. And I think there's this constant dualism between saying, oh, they're non-human, right? They're absolutely, definitely non-human, but they also look very human. Mm-hmm. There's the manager of the center saying, oh, because they look so human-like, we've had people fall in love with them. And obviously that's terrible because they're plants. Mm-hmm. And we also have, as you said, this intimate relationship. We actually have our protagonist falling in love with Lara Pinta. And she tells herself, before she enters into a sexual relationship with her, that she has to remain aware of her non-humanness out of respect, basically. So she has to accept that she is other, and that is something that needs to be respected. So I think that's also an interesting point of view.
Yeah, but from a structural, well, not exactly a structural, but from a conceptual perspective, the narrative comes at this with very latent speculation. For all those of you who want to follow along, this is on page 96. On the bottom of the page, it reads, the vision goes back at least as far as Aristotle, distinguished between plants which generally do not, move, and animals which often are mobile to catch their food. Second question is harder, is what is a human? So the very question is right there. The table, and it is being asked. And I found this interesting because, of course, the story engages and the narrative engages in answering, well, not exactly answering, but in trying to come up with answers through action, through agency, through things that happen. But is posed right there, the reader, completely unambiguous and unequivocal.
Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, the reference to Aristotle is quite striking as well, because that's the Western way of thinking, basically. It goes back to Greek antiquity. And it's not necessarily a worldview that is shared by people throughout the world. And it's also something that's being questioned by scientists these days. I mean, plants which generally do not move, animals which are mobile. What about mushrooms? They seem nowadays to be seen more similar to animals than to plants. And I'm sure there's plenty of other examples. Lucas?
I said, and they're neither, right? They're fungi.
It's a difficult question.
A Venus flytrap, I just bought one because, you know, COVID life, got to keep yourself busy. And, you know, this is a plant that eats animals by moving.
By moving, right.
So, you know, what can be said? You know, lock your doors. The plants are coming for you. No. But the idea of a plant subjectivity being something that we could consider is something I think that's really important too. And I think the argument in a way is cutting across a lot of different political lines. And that's why I really agree with David overall on this idea that maybe they're devaluing all these really strong political arguments a little bit by not making it a bit more clearly political in the sense of its generic conventions.
Mm-hmm.
Because, it's a debate, right, whether sci-fi is more suited to the political, but certainly it has been more concerned with it.
Than I agree. Ones, right?
mean, we haven't touched upon climate fiction yet. We might also go down the climate fiction route and actually say, well, if we can't decide for a label, and if you want to come up with a nice hybrid that has been around for a couple of years now, check out the Buzz video on climate fiction. But
I was about to say,
yeah, it does have that in there, because in the same section that I just read, what it does, it takes that very anthropocenic human exceptionalism, turns it around and knocks it on the head. And it is very blatant in doing that. So very openly questions and challenges that human exceptionalism, which is at the same time at the heart of post-humanism as thought experiment, post-humanism as an approach to question what it means to be human in the 21st century with all the things that are happening and going on around us. Then I can't help thinking that even though it does attack that, and even though it does critique that, and even though it is very much anti-human exceptionalism, it is so profoundly human in the things that it expresses and in the things that it talks about, like affection, like love. So isn't there a very contradictory movement and counter-movement kind of thing going on? Because it tries to dethrone and decenter the human being and human, well, the human exceptional perspective, doing this via engaging in something that couldn't be more human.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's so true. It constantly sort of, you know, balances between these two very, very different points. And while Lucas already said that Lara Pinter is shown to be doing a lot of reading, and that is also a very human activity. And she's reading, at some point, she's reading Mills and Boone novels, so romance fiction. So that's, it's an interesting contradiction. And it, I don't know, maybe it mirrors the intimate relationship between Lara Pinter and Caden. Here we have Caden, the human, with the non-human, but at the same time, they've got a very human relationship. I don't know, what do you guys think about it?
About the love relationship?
Yeah,
I've become more and more convinced that it's like a bait and switch. Like, that it's more about the political aspects of the relationship than the relationship itself. I think originally I felt like it was just a very intimate, special thing between a non-human and a human agent. But the more I've been thinking about it, the more I'm just like, ah, but really, romance fiction? And I don't mean that in a derogatory way, but I'm meaning that in a, what are we building as a politics here? And the politics is, what is the readership of romance novels? The older generation, typically. So we're talking about a dialogue between the older and the newer generation, and we're doing it by couching it in the genres, conventions of literary history as well. That almost like seems like overkill to me, but it's like very politicized at every moment by engaging in this way.
Right. I mean, the relationship is a lesbian one as well, and that's also politicized. It's also political in a way, because it's still not as accepted as it should be, right? At the same time, the relationship itself is described in quite a detailed, sensual manner. So that may be where you were getting these feelings of it being very intimate and very lovingly described from. Maybe that's where that
comes
from.
I think it also kind of inoculates, I guess, the reader against the political aspects to some extent. Like, it's not like, oh, wow, this is just hitting me over the head the whole time. Because at least we've got something else, you know, that juice, right, or whatever.
I think elsewhere, and you'll find it when you check out that other podcast, I kind of grilled or offered a little rant about how I think that romance or these romantic subplots aren't always appropriate, or how I am uncomfortable with thinking about why these things might be the things that a story always refers back to and always boils down to at the end of the day. I'm curious about whether fiction or entertaining literature, a good story, could still work without that element, but I'll have to kind of make the exception with respect to water, because I think we all agree on the fact that the very juice and the very mojo of that story can only happen because there is that intimate relationship between a human being and another being that is more than human. superhuman, post-human, whatever, all the labels you have available could be applied here. A being that is remote past of what we think human beings are, whatever. So it's got to be there. It's vital. Mm-hmm. I have to admit it. It's that deliberate clash of things.
Yeah.
And the question, does it have to be a clash? Is it one? Does it have to be one? And why do we think there is one? I mean, this is pretty much about us as readers, right? Why do we think there is something odd happening? And if we think there is, either with respect to gender questions, or respect to human, non-human, more than human relationships, if we think something's odd and if we think something's weird, that's about us. It's not about the story. It's about our readers' responses. Anyway,
right.
I think that the story is very good at being quite provocative when it comes to that, not for the sake of being provocative, but in order to, well, make us look ourselves in the eye, you know, the mirror, so to speak, reflecting upon our own positionalities and where it is that we are coming from.
Yeah, actually, I was going to say that water maybe could also work if Lara Pinter and Caden had a platonic relationship. But then that would take away this idea of the forbidden sexual relationship and the question of can we cross this bridge between human and other than human, more than human, in this intimate manner. At the same time, platonic relationships can be just as intimate, but they are not often seen that way. A sexual relationship is seen much more often in a controversial way if it crosses boundaries like that. It also allows them to talk about gender, because Lara Pinter basically has no real concept of human gender. And she asks Caden at some point, what, she has short hair, does she still feel like a woman? And that's probably only possible in this particular constellation, in the lesbian relationship as well.
I think, as it usually happens, us hanging out together and just talking and chatting about fiction that we like in a very casual sort of way, not only do we keep confusing our viewers and listeners, but newsflash, guys, that's the way it goes, at least in the humanities and in literary studies. But I think we should maybe wrap it up somewhere and pose a couple of questions for all the beautiful people studying this class with us to discuss in the forum, maybe.
Yeah, we're looking forward to your contributions, and that's it from us today.
Yeah, bye. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and take care. Yeah.